This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. We're still fresh into the new year. It's a time of year when we look for change in ourselves and maybe some extra change in your pocket. Now, how much of that kind of change you find might depend if your employer happens to be paying a living wage, or if your state is one of the 24 that will raise their state minimum wage this year. A lot of Americans, in fact, millions of us, have a hard time getting by even with full-time work. Costs go up, wages might, though not as fast. And the danger is that something's got to give. So whose responsibility is it to ensure all workers make enough to make ends meet? How much does it matter to employers, and what does receiving a living wage mean for workers? We'll answer that question for the start of our new monthly series, Priced Out. It's a collaboration between 1A and our home station, WAMU. Every first Monday of the month, we'll look at what it means to get by in America today and ask whether just getting by is enough. Today's installment, a living wage. WAMU's Sasha Ann Simons kicks us off in Washington, D.C.
In 2009, the world economy was reeling, and worker and employer anxieties were high as the job unemployment rate crept up, right along with mounting bills for cash-strapped Americans and sweeping home foreclosures. At the time of this economic upheaval, the federal minimum wage was $7.25 an hour. During the last decade, and at the beginning of this new year, the average cost of a house here in the U.S. rose $72,400. And food? It also got more expensive to buy groceries. This is all according to the most recent U.S. Census data. Throughout it all, the federal minimum wage has remained the same, $7.25 an hour. Hardly enough to stave off poverty, but whose responsibility should it be to ensure all people are paid enough to live? I spoke with Anika Hobbs, owner of the D.C.-based Nubian Human. I was curious about her thoughts on the idea of employers paying their employees a living wage.
Living wage is an interesting thing. You know, there's a base that you feel like people should have in order to live a decent life.
A decent life. That's one definition of a living wage, but how else could we define it? Ed Lazier, the executive director of the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute, had some thoughts, too.
The reason that we talk about living wages in the first place is the fact that we have an economy that doesn't guarantee that even if you work full time, that you actually have enough to meet your basic expenses. And that's really what the living wage concept is, right? What does it really take to have housing and transportation and food and healthcare and so on? And then what does that translate into a wage? The minimum wage is a floor. The living wage should be something that is much closer to what it really takes to live on.
Here's Anika again.
You know, I had this unique position of being like kind of on both sides of the fence. You know, you understand as an employer that you have numbers you need to make. You have cost per hour. I mean, I'm constantly counting cost per hour. You know, how much are we making this hour? How much is it worth? How much does it cost to have this person here this day? How many people do I have in store? How many people do I have outside of store? What does that look like? So that's something I'm constantly thinking about.
It's a lot for a business owner to keep track of on a constant basis. But like Anika said,
but then on the other side, it's like you understand that your team has responsibilities, right? Outside of just your business. So, you know, they're going to school, they have children, there's things that they're interested in, they have businesses of their own. And how does the money that you put in their pocket support that and allow them to allow that to flourish and grow along with them working for your business?
Though not required by law, Anika pays her employees the living wage in Washington, D.C., $14.50 an hour. And while it does cost her more financially, paying the living wage may be earning her something else.
I believe in her vision, so I'm willing to do more than just a regular job.
That's Jason Anderson. He's employed by Anika at Nubian Human.
You know, like a Kmart paying me a wage, like, when I clock out, I don't care. Like, I'm off. Like, don't ask me about no staplers. Like, I don't, you know what I'm saying? I don't know nothing about none of that. Whereas, though, so when you are invested in somebody's dream, like, you want them to succeed too.
But Anika didn't pay the living wage expecting anything in return.
I want to pay. I pay the living wage, and I want to pay so much more, you know?
The cost can be high for some business owners who pay a living wage to their employees.
I want to pay so much more. I want people to work for Nubian Human and say, I can't leave them. They're just so awesome, you know? But it's the cost is high.
Even with the benefit of receiving a living wage, when I asked him, Jason wasn't too optimistic about whether the idea of a living wage will extend across the country or if change is even possible.
I'm just not quite sure how to go about it because you're speaking of a system that's in place, how the country operates. That's just how the country operates. And to be quite honest, you can't reform systems like that, because they're in place and they work like a well-oiled machine.
Reform may be possible, though. Several states have stepped in, raising their minimum wage while the federal government doesn't. And here in the district, the D.C. City Council has taken some steps of its own.
We'll get to more of what the District of Columbia and states across the country are doing to address the living wage a little bit later, and we'll hear some of your stories as well. Joining me right now in studio at our home station, WAMU, race and identity reporter Sasha Ann Simons. Sasha, great report. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
You spoke to Anika. You spoke to Jason. Talk a little bit more about the tension, if that's what you can call it, for people like Anika who believe in a living wage, want to provide a living wage. She is also a businesswoman and she cannot afford to go under. That doesn't help anybody. Talk a little bit more about her beliefs in that regard and what it takes.
Well, Anika has it lucky in the sense that she does have a great group of employees that understand her struggle. They understand that it's difficult for her to figure out how to do this all. You just kind of laid it out beautifully, where she's juggling with, how do I pay these people enough money that they can live and they can support their families and do what they need to do, and also make some money and support my bottom line, and recognizing that these people are just helping me pursue my own dream. And so how do I sort of balance that out? And so what she does is she pays this living wage, but she can't really offer much else. So they don't really get benefits and they don't get, you know, other things that other full-time employees would enjoy, but she gives birthdays off, or she'll take them on trips when she goes to New York to do, you know, buying for the store, things like that. So she tries to make it sort of a balancing act.
It's not the rule in the District of Columbia that you have to pay a living wage, but the minimum wage is going up to right around that point that is a living wage in the district.
Yes.
Is this just a semantic difference at this point in the District of Columbia between
yes.
a living wage and a minimum wage?
It really is. Yeah. I mean, the minimum wage is $14. The living wage is $14.50. As of July 1st, 2020, the minimum wage here in D.C. will be $15. And so, we're really talking the difference of 50 cents here.
When did the District of Columbia start taking into consideration this idea of a living wage? I got to say, like, there's a national debate over a minimum wage all the time, the ghastly
yes.
$7.25 from Congress. But the idea of a living wage, enough to get by and get your needs met.
In D.C., it began 14 years ago. So it was called the Living Wage Act of 2006. And really, it shows that the District of Columbia is a longtime leader in progressive wage policy. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, D.C. was actually the first jurisdiction to mandate a minimum wage higher than $10 an hour back in 2015. And D.C. is among the first jurisdictions to pass the living wage law when they did so back in 2006. But that being said, it's really important to note D.C. is one of the most expensive places to live, with some of the worst income inequality. You know, to afford an average two-bedroom in Washington, a worker would need to make $32.02 an hour, and that's more than double the D.C. living wage. So we still have a ways to go.
And in a town like Washington, D.C., that is gentrifying rapidly, that means a lot of things. It also means rents go up. And this constant race, right, between not only what you make, but what it takes.
Exactly.
And what it takes continues to rise.
Exactly. What it actually takes to live. And, you know, over the last 14 years, the living wage rate has only been increased twice for inflation, once back in 2016 and then when it was up to 1385. And then, of course, last January when it went up to the 1450 rate. But again, when we take into consideration what a person should actually make, the living wage calculator by MIT says that a single person in D.C. should be making at least $17.64 an hour. So like more than $3 more than what it actually is, and a little over $30 an hour if they have at least one child. So again, we are way off from where we should be.
So even with this relatively progressive minimum wage / living wage in the District of Columbia, still lagging behind that other number.
Still a disconnect.
What it takes. AC Monroe likes to tweet us all the time, and we're glad. If a business owner can't afford to pay the employees a livable wage, then they don't deserve to be in business, period. No one in any country, county in America today can afford to get by on the federal minimum wage. I don't know if people are quite that insistent in the District of Columbia, but that attitude seems to have taken root.
Absolutely. It's, again, not enough business owners are like Anika Hobbs. I mean, she was sort of one story, but this idea for my reporting sparked from a living wage session that was happening in the district where a nonprofit, as well as a lot of DC government officials, were present to talk about where to take this. And I know we'll get to more of that later in the hour, but there were so many business owners that were there that weren't quite there yet where Anika was. And so they were looking to find ways to get there.
And you have to ask not only about the Anikas of the world, but the Best Buys and the Targets there in my neighborhood, too, in the District of Columbia. You know, according to the most recent numbers, which are from 2 years ago, the living wage for the American family of four is $16.07 an hour. The federal minimum that we keep talking about is less of half that and hasn't budged in a decade, over a decade. We're going to add some more voices, including yours, to our conversation with Sasha Ann Simons. So stay with us. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. It's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're talking about a living wage in America as part of our series Priced Out with WAMU race and identity reporter Sasha Ann Simons. Getting by is a huge issue across this country. So we're opening the phones to you. Are you a worker? How are you making ends meet? Or are you a business owner? Do you feel you should be paying a living wage to your employees? And how do you decide how to do it? You can call us 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212. Remember, you can always comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A, the email address 1A@WAMU.org. And we got this email from Ray, who says a living wage is a personal responsibility. Make sure you prepare for the workforce by getting the proper training and education. Depending on the government or an employer to raise your lot in life is a losing proposition. That's from Ray. Let's add some more voices in this conversation. Joining Sasha and me in studio, Professor Adriana Kugler. She's professor of economics and foreign policy at Georgetown University. She's also the former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor in the Obama administration from 2011 to 2013. Professor Kugler, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Todd.
David Cooper is also here. He's senior economic analyst at the Economic Policy Institute. They're a nonpartisan think tank that researches economic policies and their impact. David, it's good to have you here.
Great to be here.
Professor Kugler, we heard a little bit in Sasha's piece from Ed Lazare about how to define a minimum or a living wage. But could you take a second and break that down for us a little bit more? How do we define a living wage in America? It's different from the minimum wage. Obviously, the minimum is the minimum. How do we put our hands around what it actually takes to get by versus what you can make at your job?
So a good way to frame this is to think about the poverty line. The poverty line is defined by the census, by the U.S. Census, and it's defined as the amount of money you need yearly to meet your needs, and that includes shelter, food, all the basic necessities, not beyond necessities, but just necessities. For a family of four today, that's about $26,000 a year. With the $7.25 federal minimum wage, even if you work full-time with no vacation whatsoever, that would get you as far as $15,000 a year. So that would put you way off basically being able to meet the basic necessities, which would be the equivalent of a living wage.
Not even close.
Yes.
Well, the federal minimum wage, we've said, is the same as it was in 1999. More than half of states here in the United States have laws now requiring employees be paid more than that federal minimum wage, but only about half. The minimum wage in Illinois has gone from $9.25 an hour to $10.25. Washington State has gone from $12 to $13.50 on the first of the month of this year. And on September 1st, Connecticut will raise its minimum wage from $11 to $12. David, what does all of this and all these numbers tell us about how Americans are getting by, more importantly, if they're getting by?
Well, I think it tells us that a lot of Americans are struggling to get by, and they're asking their representatives and government to do something about it. As you said, the federal minimum wage hasn't been changed in 10 years. But in that time, in the absence of federal action, we've had folks in, as you mentioned, 29 states across the country enacting laws to raise their state minimum wages. We've also had about 40 local jurisdictions raising their own local minimum wages, all trying to address this problem that you've discussed, that for folks at the bottom of the wage distribution, what they're being paid is just nowhere near what it takes for them to actually afford their basic needs.
We got this message from Lady of the Farm, who tweeted, "I appreciate the idea of a minimum wage, but I think it prevents small businesses from thriving and individuals from pursuing entrepreneurship." This is an old debate when it comes to minimum wage, finding that sweet spot between giving people enough to live in a fair wage versus the point where it starts to make it difficult for employers to expand and to hire. Professor, what do we know about that balance? And is there evidence that a minimum wage actually damages jobs?
That's a great question, Todd. One of the arguments against raising the minimum wage is that it has these unintended consequences on the people it is supposed to help, that oftentimes employers facing these higher costs will stop hiring people, that they will reduce the number of hours they offer to the workers they actually choose to keep. But in fact, very recent evidence and the evidence that we have actually accumulated over the years shows that there is very little evidence of disemployment, that in fact, the minimum wage doesn't seem to reduce the amount of workers hired. And if anything, it keeps them the same. On the other hand, it does increase earnings and take home pay for workers. And a very good recent example of that, as David was saying, is several local jurisdictions have chosen to increase the minimum wage. One of those was Seattle. Seattle raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And when it raised the minimum wage, people predicted that because Seattle did this unilaterally, that businesses would leave Seattle. And in fact, jobs would be lost and people would be losing their employment and hours would be reduced. And in fact, there is very little evidence of that, even going up to $15 an hour.
And the studies and counter studies flew out of Seattle and Washington State because the rest of America is watching this. The rest of America knows wages have to go up, but nobody wants to be the local politician to make them go up so far, too far, that is. David, we talk about a living wage, getting the basics, getting your needs met. What happens when it doesn't happen in terms of policy? What happens when we have millions of people who work hard but can't get their basic needs met by what they make?
Yeah. Well, a lot of those folks have to turn to public assistance programs. So they're relying on things like food stamps and housing assistance and whatever other safety net programs we make available to them to try and pay their bills at the end of the week. But, you know, the truth is most of those programs are probably not generous enough for many of them to afford their basic needs. So they need to be getting more out of their participation in the labor market in order to achieve a decent life. The other thing that happens is that we potentially have a much weaker economy. Because remember, about two-thirds of the U.S. economy is consumption. It's people going out and buying things. If you have an entire class of workers that are not getting enough money to go out and buy the things that they need, that means that consumption is going to be depressed.
They're not spending.
Exactly. Businesses aren't going to have customers coming through the door that they would have otherwise if those folks had enough income.
That's the policy. Let's bring it back to the personal, Sasha. Yeah. We talk about basic needs and getting them met. Mm-hmm. You can talk about here in the District of Columbia, if you like, it may not be that much different from places all across America. What does that mean for people who are working 8, 10, 12 hours a day and still not being able to get what they need?
Yeah, the idea here is that, you know, a working adult should be able to afford these basic things on their own, and like David said, without the need of private or public assistance. So the self-sufficiency standard accounts for six basic needs, which are housing, childcare, food, transportation, healthcare, and miscellaneous expenses. So that includes things like clothing, telephone services, cleaning products, for instance. And it calculates the cost with the assumption that all adults in a household are working full time. What the basic necessities does not include is things that Americans typically like to spend their money on. So it doesn't budget for dining out and restaurants or like entertainment or unpaid vacations or holidays, things like that.
David.
Yeah, I wanted to just go back and make a point on this question about the business response and what, you know, the harm that it may cause to businesses. And I think Anika's story at the top was a great example, because she talked about the benefits that she receives from paying higher wages, the fact that her employees stick around, the fact that her workers work a little harder. And also, I would note that if you're raising wages through a minimum wage increase, all of Anika's competitors are going to be paying higher wages too, and all their workers are consumers, so they're potentially going to be coming through Anika's door to buy more goods and services.
Well, let's hear from a business owner himself. We have William on the line from Arkansas. William, you're listening to David say that paying a living wage can raise all boats in your community. What do you say?
I agree to some degree, but at the same time, I know we try and pay as much as we can to our employees. I agree with Anika. We've seen the same benefit. We really believe in taking care of our employees, and we've seen the benefit of that. But Arkansas is a very the cost of living is very low. And so if you across the board raise the living wage up to a point where the cost of living is so low like it is in Arkansas, it could really, really damage all the small businesses. Now, larger businesses may be able to absorb that, but as a small business owner, it's a struggle. And there's a lot of the work that we do ourselves to save money already. And I'm just afraid that it's going to shut down a lot of our small businesses.
William, what's your business? What business are you in?
We have a small food business, retail, and we have people that come in. And we do very good business, but it's still, a struggle to be competitive in the food industry, period, anywhere that you're at.
All right, William, I want to thank you for joining us here on 1A. We appreciate your perspective as a business owner there in Arkansas. Connor owns a business in Toledo, Ohio. Connor, you're listening to this argument that a living wage helps everybody. What's your point of view?
Well, thanks for having me. And I'm a huge fan of the living wage. However, owning my own business and trying to hire good blue-collar employees is a challenge. I have to stay competitive, but at the same time, I have a 40% workers' comp fee on top of my wages. So if I'm paying someone $15 an hour, they're seeing $15 an hour, but really that's like 22... it's in the 20s an hour for me. And so trying to stay competitive, keep good guys on, but with these high workers' comp rates, it's a challenge to keep competitive prices in the marketplace. And slowly I'm seeing lower middle class and middle class customers being priced out of really essential tree work that could, trees that are dangerous that could.
So you're a tree doctor, Connor? You got guys climbing trees and roping up and cutting down branches?
Exactly.
Dangerous work.
And a lot of dangerous stuff over houses.
Yeah.
And,
all right. Well, Connor, thanks for joining us and for sharing the details of your business. I appreciate it. Professor Kugler, two business owners who seem to have a theme. They believe in a living wage, but one size can't fit all. In Arkansas, the cost of living is low, so don't give me a living wage that's too high for my community. Connor says what a lot of business owners say, that the living wage, the wage doesn't tell the whole story. I got to pay 40% workman's comp because people are climbing trees to cut them down and I have to be insured.
So there are two things that I heard from them. One of them is that there is actually a benefit. And the benefit is reduced absenteeism, right? Increased effort from their workers, potentially reduce turnover down the road. If an individual business does this alone, it doesn't really bring all the benefits one would want. As David was saying, one of the big benefits of increasing the minimum wage is that it will bring income for low-wage workers who actually spend most of their money because they can't afford to save, so their propensity to consume is quite high. And these actually triple kills to the economy. It generates what is known as a multiplier effect. It really causes the rest of the economy to thrive. So when you do it individually, it's true, it won't make sense. But that's why you need federal laws. That's why you need maybe potentially state laws also to increase beyond the federal minimum wage.
We got this email from Pat who says, I'm a cafe owner in a small central New York village. I'm progressive in my political outlook. I try to do the best by my 10 employees. Our minimum wage was just increased to $11.80 an hour, and I shudder every time I hear that people are suffering at $15 an hour. We've been hearing from many of you around the country, workers and business owners alike. Here's Elizabeth in Michigan.
The real truth is there are many places in America that are affordable, but they're not considered desirable. So, for instance, I moved here in July of this past year. I bought a house for $25,000 cash. Nice little house, two bedrooms, big backyard, nice neighborhood. I moved here from the Phoenix, Arizona area where I lived for about 5 years, tried to buy a house for about 3 years. Cheapest house I could find was about $300,000. So I couldn't afford that.
David, Elizabeth says mobility, even if it happens to too many people, we call that migration, moving to places that are more affordable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think people hopefully have the means to find places that are more affordable. You know, if you're a low-income worker, you probably don't have a big budget for packing up the moving truck and traveling great distances to find a cheaper cost of living. But the truth is, you know, there are lots of ways that you can calculate a living wage. We mentioned the MIT living wage calculator at the top. My organization, the Economic Policy Institute, has its own calculator called the Family Budget Calculator. And when you look at the data in that, that shows that even in the cheapest county in America, you cannot get by, you cannot achieve that calculator's level of a secure but modest standard of living for less than $14 an hour. And ironically, that county is actually near Toledo, where the gentleman was just speaking. So if the truth is, you know, even though folks are maybe searching for lower costs of living, we need to be talking about minimum wages significantly higher than they are today in most of the country, if even in the lowest cost areas of the country, if folks are going to be able to achieve a secure standard of living.
Sasha, I'll take you outside of the District of Columbia. There are reports of people in Los Angeles making $50,000 a year, a great salary, living in their cars.
Wow.
Because they can't afford rent anywhere in LA, even on a salary that to many, many people would seem like a dream. Now,
right.
That's LA, maybe where the cost of living is especially high. It makes me wonder what you found out about how not getting what it takes affects people's lives, what they have to do to get by when they can't get what it takes.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's clear. The bottom line is DC is super expensive, as I mentioned earlier, and the living wage rate is simply too low. And so for people like Jason Anderson, who I spoke to, who works in Anika Hobbs' store, you know, the living wage for him was the difference between being able to support his two young children and not. And, you know, for him, you know, they're primarily with him. Their mother has them on the weekends. Mind you, he works part-time at Nubian Human and has two other jobs. So he's working two other jobs plus this $14.50 an hour job. So it all has to work together in order to be able to make ends meet. And but common sense and, you know, the cost of living here in D.C. will tell us that the living wage, like I said, is unrealistically low. In our newsroom at WAMU, I do want to mention we are focusing on covering issues of affordability. And so I've been talking to a lot of folks over the past few months about different issues to do with affordability. And I'll mention the living wage law to some. And I have encountered more and more people who had no idea what the living wage rate was. They were like, what? Living wage? What are you talking about? And so I find myself explaining in there, you know, because again, as we mentioned off top, small businesses aren't legally obligated to do so just yet. But the idea of this living wage and something that was more attainable, it just sounded like it was going to be so much more. And I had to sort of break it to them like, no, it really is just 50 cents at this time.
We're going to take a break, getting through so many of your comments, workers, business owners. Harry sent us this email. I don't see how a living wage is justified for a job that requires a minimum skill or education level. People should be paid according to what they bring to the job. A clerk at Target or a cashier at McDonald's does not deserve a living wage unless the job market forces higher wages in order to fill those vacancies. Deserve is kind of a loaded word, but after this break, we're going to talk about living wages in places like McDonald's and Targets and Walmarts and Amazons and what it might do to our costs. Hey, I love shopping at Amazon. I don't want my prices to go up, I'm going to be honest. So we're going to talk about effects across the economy, what it means for all of us if a living wage becomes policy. I'm Todd Zwillick. Stick with us. This is 1A. I read Harry's email before the break saying that workers of a limited skill level or education shouldn't necessarily be paid a living wage. A clerk at Target or somebody working on the register at McDonald's doesn't necessarily merit a living wage in the economy, and we should be careful about overinflating those wages. You wanted to respond, David Cooper.
Well, I think, you know, that may be Harry's philosophy, may be that we don't need to help those folks, that everyone's out, you know, on their own. But I think generally as a society, we have felt that folks should be able to afford their basic needs. And we have to find some way of ensuring that they do, either through labor standards requiring businesses to act in certain ways or through help from the government. But I think it's really important to keep in mind, to take a look at where the federal minimum wage is today, where it was in the past. The fact is that today, low-wage workers in this country have far more education and are far older than low-wage workers back in, say, the 1960s. And at that time, the federal minimum wage was equal to about $10.50 in today's dollars when you adjust for inflation. So in other words, workers at the federal minimum wage today are making about 30% less than their counterparts a generation ago, despite the fact that they have that they're older, they have more education, higher skills. So they're starting, even if folks are starting out in the labor market, even if this is their first job, even if they are low skilled, they're starting out from a position that is much farther away from the middle class than their predecessors in the previous generation. And that's going to hamstring them for the rest of their lives, the rest of their careers, the rest of their time in the labor market.
Let's talk about what happens if we commit to a living wage, let's say as a cultural move, right? Americans just become for it. Now, look, I'm a little bit selfish, I'll admit it. I like low prices at Target. I like shopping on Amazon for low, low prices. I have a friend who I spoke to over the holidays who's a picker at an Amazon fulfillment center. The pay isn't great. The working conditions are pretty lousy. And I don't think it should be that way. On the other hand, low, low prices, Amazon.com makes me a happy consumer, Professor. Do Americans have to commit to paying a little bit more across the board if we all want to commit to the idea of a living wage that raises all of us up?
So very good question, Todd. And I think the key here is a little bit. And that's exactly what happens. And that's exactly why we don't find employers actually displacing workers and deciding not to hire, because part of these additional costs in the minimum wage gets passed on to the consumers. But it's just a little bit. And that's the key, because if it was a lot, then people wouldn't buy, and that impacts the business, and the business would not hire the workers. But that's not what we're seeing. So in fact, what we're seeing is that, yes, there is a little bit passed on to the consumers, but the consumers don't seem to be reducing the amount that they buy. And so the benefits actually go to those low-wage workers. And again, we know that those low-wage workers spend quite a bit of money themselves. In fact, there is an estimate that by EPI that $118 billion would be created if we increase the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. And that money gets spread out through the economy. So there is that additional benefit that we have to consider as we think about this issue.
And if prices are low at Target, maybe another dollar an hour or something at a place, not singling you out, Target, but a place like Target, might mean that more people spend at Target. Right.
That's exactly right.
Now, we've been getting a lot of response from a sector of the workforce that has a particular interest in the living wage, people with disabilities. We've been hearing from them on their phones. We've been hearing from them as we've been prepping this show. William, you're in Florida. You've been listening to our reporters and our experts. Tell me about your experience in the workforce, your wages, and what it takes for you to get by.
Well, I make $16 an hour. My wife is disabled. And so I generally work 50 to 65 hours a week. I'm in the construction industry. My biggest concern is if they go up on minimum wage, my company is not going to give me enough raise to offset the difference. So if y'all go from $8 an hour to $14 an hour minimum wage, well, I've just lost $6 an hour buying power, and I might get a raise for another dollar an hour. So you have put me in a situation, my wife and I, into a lower income bracket. Hmm.
William,
so
does your
that's the situation.
Does your wife with her disability also rely on federal or state programs for her care?
Yeah, she's $900 a month. Mm-hmm. And so that's very minimal. She was in the medical field, and she became disabled after her birth of her child. And so she's been in a situation where she's been disabled for about 15 years.
William, thanks for joining us. David, it's an important point. Now, William makes $16 an hour. He's worried that if a wage mandate boosts that mandate too high, that he's not going to lose his job, but he's just not going to get the raises that he needs to keep he and his wife healthy and making it.
Well, first of all, I think as Dr. Kugler was saying, we know that the price response from a minimum wage increase tends to be very small. So in other words, even though William may have to pay a little more for the things he goes out and buys, it's not going to be that much. But secondly,
he's also worried about his employer saying, well, I've got to meet this mandate for all the other people. So, William, I can't give you that raise to 19. It can only be $17.50.
I mean, it is true that if an employer has to pay their lowest paid workers a little bit more, they may defer some of the increases higher up the wage ladder. But, you know, again, we have to try and think about what folks at the absolute bottom are making and are they able to afford their needs. The other point I thought he was making was that, you know, his wife relies on some federal assistance programs and he's concerned that if his income goes up, that he's going to lose some of those benefits as a result of the higher pay he's getting. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the vast majority of those programs are not one, they don't reduce your benefits one to one. So in other words, for every additional dollar in income you receive, you're not going to lose a dollar in benefits. So on net, he should be better off.
We got this call from Keith in Fort Myers, Florida, who left a message sharing his experience with us.
Hi, my name is Keith. I'm from Fort Myers, Florida. I happen to be a disabled veteran and a old registered nurse, EMT, paramedic, firefighter even. Living on Social Security disability makes things very tight. I've had to resort to visiting food pantries as much as possible, but even that can be sometimes difficult with my health conditions and trying to get up and going. I had to resort to asking the minister of our church a couple times for funds as well. And it's a shame that we've got to live this way.
Now, a living wage, we're talking about working in wages, and we should be. But Keith in Fort Myers, Florida, is on federal disability Social Security. He has a wage, too. It may come from the government because maybe he can't work. But what about a living wage for the programs that people like Keith rely on, Professor?
Yeah, that's a good point. When we estimate these poverty lines for a family of one, two, three, or four, we do it on average, right? But certainly people with disabilities have to be meeting other basic needs. And those basic needs include additional health costs that are quite expensive, or like in the case of your previous caller, where they have a spouse that has needs for him to be able to get out to work. He has to have somebody take care of his wife while he's away. So when we think about these living wages and poverty lines, we're talking on average. And certainly people with disabilities have many additional hurdles to overcome. And that's why you have things like the American with Disabilities Act of 1990 to allow people who can actually work, even with their disabilities, to be accommodated in the workplace and to get the right wages and right accommodations. which is even better than going on SSDI, to be honest, because that way they can remain active, remain engaged. But that's not always possible.
That's why
your disability is very severe.
And that's why it's so important that so many of you are joining us for this conversation, because the averages are important, but they can obscure the personal reality. We got this email from Jen, who says, in response to the caller who stated that people need to prepare themselves for the workforce and make sure they have appropriate skills to get the kind of job that can pay the bills, that's an incredibly privileged position from which to address this issue. Not everyone has access to educational programs or job training. People who grow up in poverty or have families to support may not have the budget or even the time to try to improve a job skill in the first place. And Sasha, I read that and I think that probably reflects the dilemma of a lot of people in the District of Columbia.
It does. And it reminds me of a conversation I had with a business owner who was also in my story, in addition to Anika Hobbs. But this woman, she owned a wireless company in the district. And, you know, she is a business owner who is paying the living wage. However, she was really adamant that, you know, paying this living wage, I should be able to say, what are you then bringing to the table? So are you bringing the skills that I'm going to need you to have for this type of work if this is what I'm supposed to continue doing? She was also very adamant that the government should be stepping in to assist employers in some way to be able to sustain.
One question I have for our experts is the question why. It's kind of a simple question, and we can forget to ask it. It seems like with something so big as what people make across America, all the different states, Arkansas versus Ohio, it can just seem like general inertia of the economy that leads to so many millions of Americans not being able to make what it takes. But these are policy decisions. These are the results of decisions of lawmakers, people we elect, people we empower to make decisions about the economy. Help me understand a little bit, Professor, if you can, about how we got here and what the decisions were that led to so many millions of Americans not making a living wage. I mean, the money has gone somewhere.
So I think the key to understanding why we have this inertia in the policy arena is to understand that the people who are being affected by these policies are really the most vulnerable. There are about 2 million people earning the minimum wage or less. These are the people who are trying to make their ends meet, try to feed their families. They don't necessarily have time to go out and mobilize and go to their legislators and go to policymakers to make their case. As Anika was mentioning before, as Sasha was mentioning before, there is the case as well that people may not even know. They may not even be informed about what a living wage is. So there's lack of information and lack of action because they can't afford to even get out there. And to get the support of everybody else, people would need to understand much better what the general benefits to the economy are. And I don't think that's very well understood today.
I just want to add a little historical context here. As I mentioned earlier, the federal minimum wage in the late 1960s was the equivalent of about $10.50 per hour in today's dollars. Throughout the 1970s, Congress raised the federal minimum wage a handful of times, but it was a period of pretty high inflation, so the value kept sort of stayed flat. Throughout the 1980s, we didn't touch the minimum wage at all. So it stayed where it was. And over that time, inflation was just eating away at its value. And the increases that we've made in the federal minimum wage since then in the 1990s and the 2000s have never been large enough to undo that erosion in value that took place throughout the 1980s. So that, I think, is also, you know, important to understand that this is the decision of folks in power to neglect this policy, and in doing so, leave millions of workers today earning less than they would be earning otherwise.
We should stop talking about the federal minimum wage staying stagnant since 1999. It's gone down because what you can buy with that money goes down year after year after year. The purchasing power is worse.
Since 2009, not 1999.
Sorry, 2009
has declined about 17% since 2009.
We got this note from Ellis who says, as a consumer, I don't mind paying a little bit extra on my purchases. I know that if the people working at Target or McDonald's, etc., are being fairly compensated for their time, that it's worth my money. And we got this from Blue Appalachia. Why can't the CEOs and the people at the top take a pay cut in order to pay for people to make a living wage? Now, that gets to the big national debate about income inequality. Maybe there's not going to be a direct flow from the CEOs on down, but please tell me how overall income inequality and wage disparity in this country is connected to the problem, Professor.
So that's a very good point. In fact, we know that when you pay the minimum wage, not only minimum wage workers benefit, but also people above the minimum wage. There is what is known as a spillover effect. So this increase in the minimum wage also raises the wages for those above the minimum wage and close to the minimum wage. There is a generalized improvement for everybody down in the lower end of the distribution that would lead to compression and less inequality. And that's exactly what we've seen from evidence in the past from increases in the minimum wage.
Sasha, I want to get your final thoughts because I live in the District of Columbia too, and it's a place where a lot of high-paid people are moving in, and you're reporting on the people who are just trying to get by.
Who are just trying to get by, and I would be remiss if I did not mention that Washington, D.C. officials are hoping to entice other local businesses to pay their employees fair wages, and they're also trying to reward businesses for doing so. So they're implementing the living wage certification program that's going to happen sometime this year. Not sure when. Talks are still happening as to what exactly it'll look like. And so it'll be something, whether it's a sign hanging in your store that says we're a living wage business or employees walk around with T-shirts.
Let them advertise
something
it.
To entice others to do the same and for shoppers to want to reward you for doing
so
what you're supposed to be doing.
Those of us with wallets can take action with our dollars
exactly.
In the local community.
Vote with your wallet.
WAMU's race and identity reporter Sasha Ann Simons, great reporting. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Todd.
Appreciate it. Adriana Kluger is a professor of economics and foreign policy at Georgetown University, former chief economist for the U.S. Department of Labor in the Obama administration, 2011 to 2013. Thank you so much for your expertise, Professor. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Todd.
David Cooper is senior economic analysis at the Economic Policy Institute, EPI. We heard your numbers thrown around here during the conversation. David, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, next month, our series Priced Out continues with a little bit of a Valentine's Day special. They say love doesn't cost a thing, but finding it definitely does. The average person spends thousands of dollars dating, even for dates with their spouse, not just you singletons out there. We look at the cost of finding, keeping, and sometimes even ending a relationship. That's next month, the Valentine's edition of Priced Out from WAMU and 1A. This conversation was produced very ably by Morgan Givens. To learn more about him and the rest of the team, visit the website, the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU here in Washington, D.C., part of American University. It's distributed by NPR. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for being with us. This is 1A.